This is an ABC podcast.
Rick Shine has been obsessed with reptiles his whole life. Rick's childhood was spent arguing with his parents about why he should be allowed to keep a second diamond python as a pet. Rick became an evolutionary biologist specialising in snakes, and he's travelled all over the world to study them and their mating habits. To central Canada, where garter snakes gather once a year to swarm into a vastly huge snake orgy. Yes, a snake orgy. To a remote island off the coast of China, where a single species of snake is almost everywhere you look. Rick Shine was studying snakes in the Northern Territory near Kakadu when he realised the cane toad invasion was going to wipe out most of the local wildlife, including the snakes. And so he thought he had to become a toad specialist as well. His ingenious and counterintuitive solution to the toad invasion resulted in Rick being awarded the Prime Minister's Prize for Science in 2016. Earlier this year, Rick wrote a book called Cane Toad Wars. Hello, Rick, and welcome.
Hello.
I love this program because I get to ask occasionally a personal question. Recently, I discovered that there was in my garage a huge, beautiful diamond python right up in the corner of my garage. And on the opposite corner, there had been... There had been a possum there. And one day, a few days later, I noticed that both animals were missing. And the only thing that was left was a gigantic stripe of shed python skin dangling from the rafter down to almost the ground in my garage. And I had a lot of fun introducing my kids to this. One by one, come and have a look. It was like, what? Come and have a look, come and look. And they all went, yeah, like that, as soon as they recognised what the skin is. Is it likely possible that the python consumed that possum, took off, burst its skin essentially through its new kind of found girth, and took off just somewhere to go sleep it off and digest the possum? Does that happen?
Absolutely. The most common prey item for diamond pythons around Sydney are brush-tail possums, and a snake that has had a big meal and has grown a bit or has incurred a few injuries from the possum's claws is very likely to shed its skin to get rid of those injuries and then head off and look for another possum.
So she popped her corset, did she? Is that what she did?
If it was a big one, it was a girl. The girls are much bigger than the boys in the local pythons.
Oh, she was a big one, all right. Oh, dear, oh, dear. That's amazing. I can't wait to tell my family that. Tell me about your childhood, Rick. What kind of relationship did you have with reptiles as a kid growing up in Sydney's North Shore?
Oh, look, ever since I was walking, I think I was always fascinated by reptiles, amphibians to some degree, but really it was the lizards and snakes that really caught my attention, and I'd pot around the backyard and try and catch the little garden skinks. As I got a bit bigger, after primary school, I'd head off down to the local creek and wander around and desperately hope to find a water dragon or a blue tongue. It's been with me since I was very, very small.
How did your parents think about your reptile love?
My parents were incredibly supportive. I think they were very surprised. They thought it was a very peculiar obsession to have. My brother was into chemistry, and I was into snakes. And so, yeah, look, they didn't pretend to understand it, but I think they were just extraordinarily determined to support me and my passions. They doubtless expected that I'd grow out of it pretty soon, and it just never happened.
Guests that I've had on, like you in the past, who find that kind of fascination with an animal or some species of wildlife, it seems to act like a kind of a shield against, I don't know, boredom or depression or all those kind of things. When the natural world offers you so much, it seems to keep you curious and young, I suppose. Is that true for you?
Yeah, look, I think there's a real childlike aspect to being a biologist. The curiosity that kids feel that many of us somehow lose is retained in some people. So, yeah, how can you be bored when there's a world full of reptiles out there? We know almost nothing about them. They're glorious, elegant creatures, and it's such a privilege to be able to spend my professional life working with them.
This diamond python I saw in my garage was of course, they give off, for me anyway, for a lot of people, that feeling of awe and terror, but wonder, because it was so beautiful. It was very dark, and the diamond patterns were bluish, I think, or kind of distinct. That's how it looked in the garage at the time. Tell me about how you brought diamond pythons home when you were a kid.
Yes, well, I mean, I can vividly recall, you know, the first big diamond python. I knew the things existed from books, but I never thought I'd ever see one. And there was this giant snake crawling across the path in front of me and my friend as we walked through the bushland in northern Sydney. And I'd read that they were very mild and mellow creatures, and so I picked it up around the middle, and bless its heart, it didn't bite me, and I brought it home, you know, determined that this would be the ultimate pet. I'd had small snakes up to then, you know, green tree snakes and things like this. But perhaps unsurprisingly, my mother, who was home at the time, was rather horrified at this thing. I mean, I was a very small child, and this was a pretty large python. This was a couple of metres long and very muscular. And so I had this long conversation with Mum on the front yard where she sort of barred my way to get into the backyard where the snake cages were, trying to explain to her that this was a sweet, gentle creature and it would be no problem. I desperately wanted it. And partway through this conversation, the snake got sick of it all, and so it decided to actually bite me, and it launched this really ferocious strike at my calf, and it actually knocked me off my feet, and I had a good grip around my leg. And I continued my attempt to convince my mother of the benevolent nature of this animal, despite the fact that it had its teeth sunk into me. And I think Mum realised at that point that if I was still trying to defend the notion of keeping this thing, that it was futile arguing, and she just muttered, "You'll have to talk to your father when he comes home," and she went inside, which gave me an opportunity to extract the python from my leg and take it into the backyard.
Yeah, they're not venomous, are they? But no. They can give you a nasty bite, can't they? Because there's all sorts of bacteria on their teeth. Was that you must have had a nasty bite afterwards?
Yeah. I mean, I think I probably wore it proudly as a wound of war. They've got these small, very sharp teeth, and so it's like multiple pinpricks. The trick that pythons have got, of course, is they're incredibly powerful, so that if they can throw a coil around you as well, that coil will push those teeth very firmly into your flesh, and it can be quite a memorable experience.
So as you were explaining what a harmless creature it was coiled around your leg, as you said, and
yes,
did it give you a bit of a squeeze?
Well, it was squeezing a little. I was primarily focused on articulating the argument to Mum that this was actually a sweet creature and this was just a strange little a flash in the pan that would doubtless never happen again, and the snake must have got confused.
Oh, good on your Mum, though, recognising, though, you must have been sincere.
Absolutely.
And that you were definitely up for whatever it took, I suppose, to find out about these creatures. So then your family moved to Canberra, and there would have been very different snake varieties there, wouldn't there?
Yeah, halfway through high school, we moved to Canberra. Dad was in the public service, and I hadn't realised it, but all of the snakes around Canberra were venomous, you know, black snakes, brown snakes, tiger snakes, and so on. But I was very fortunate. My first day at the new high school, I met a kid whose brother was a snake catcher, and he was a teenager as well, and they were kind enough to take me out that weekend down to one of the rivers near Canberra, and we walked along the banks and saw a glorious red-bellied black snake basking. I'd seen those in Sydney, but I'd always run the other way because I was terrified of them. And this guy, John Womby, raced across, grabbed it by the tail, danced around with it for a while until it got tired and pinned it down with the stick and put it in a bag. And, I mean, you know, this was hero worship stuff from my perspective. And so that was it. I mean, that was my one day of education on snake catching. And after that, I went out on my own and caught black snakes and brown snakes and so on and brought them back and kept them at home.
What was the incident, though, at your high school that made your parents tell you to get rid of your snakes?
Yes, there was a very sad event when I was, I guess, a couple of years into the time in Canberra where somebody was killed by a snake bite, and it was in all the newspapers. And Mum and Dad hadn't really recognised just how dangerous these animals were. In the days before the internet, really, there was a lot of garbled misinformation. I guess the internet provides a lot of garbled misinformation as well. But it was actually pretty hard to find some of this stuff out. And they realised that I had these lethal creatures, and this was probably a pretty bad idea for a high school kid. And so we had the terrible after-dinner conversation around the dining room table where they said I had to get rid of the snakes. And I was mortified, and I argued against it, and I failed, and I went to bed in tears. And the very next day, a letter arrived saying that I'd won a scholarship that would pay part of the costs of the final couple of years at high school. And these were hard to get, and it meant that I'd been working pretty hard, and Mum and Dad, being kind-hearted souls, were horrified at this evidence that I'd been doing the right thing. And so we negotiated that I would let go of the brown snakes, but that I could keep the black snakes, which were always my favourites. And in retrospect, that was a pretty sensible compromise.
So you studied zoology and did honours and then went to the University of New England in the early 1970s in Armidale around there, catching snakes. What were you catching snakes for at that time?
Well, I'd actually started out doing my PhD on a project in lizards, and it just didn't really excite me. But whenever I found a black snake along the creek, that was fantastic. And I figured they had to be big predators of the lizards I was working on, and so this was a somewhat flimsy excuse to catch the snakes. And I ended up deciding it was justified to kill them humanely and look inside them and see what they were eating and find out how many lizards were heading down into snakes. And so I did that for that first field season, and then I had a freezer full of snakes, and at the end of that field season in winter, I started thawing them out and cutting them open and looking inside them, just asking very fundamental, simple natural history questions. What do they eat? How big are the boys? How big are the girls? How many eggs or babies do they have? How big are the eggs or babies? When do they have them? You know, a whole range of very fundamental things. And I discovered that, in fact, none of this information was known for any Australian snakes. I'd always assumed that somebody must know. But, in fact, in the early 70s, the natural history and ecology of Australian snakes was an absolute black hole.
So none other than, really, I suppose, bushmen, experienced bushmen would not really know what was inside of a snake at that point then. So there was so little science on it. As you say that, I begin to think, I don't really know what's inside a snake. I mean, they're not mammals. Do they have hearts? Do they have lungs?
Yeah, the body plan is sort of like a mammal, but stretched out to an enormous degree, and there's a whole range of packaging issues. So it's pretty hard to fit two lungs side by side. So most snakes have a single lung, and the other one's just quite vestigial. And they have, you know, kidneys and livers and so forth. But the kidneys, for example, one is above the other in the body in order so that they can both fit. Same with the ovaries, the testes. And so you've really got to stretch out the system in order to fit everything in. But broadly, the same kinds of things inside our bodies are inside the body of a snake.
Do they have ears?
They don't have any external ears. They certainly are quite capable of picking up vibrations along the ground. It's not 100% clear that they can't hear airborne sounds as well. And again, that's the kind of thing it would be kind of fun to look into. People talk about, the frog started calling down at the pond and the black snake headed in that direction. So perhaps they're capable of things that we don't understand.
Knowing you were coming on the program, this gave me the excuse to watch a whole stack of snake videos on YouTube, Rick. And I saw some basic, you know, tourist handycam footage of a snake giving birth, and I think it was somewhere in Africa, probably South Africa somewhere, I think, just from the voices I was hearing. And the mother was giving birth to live babies, and this really threw me because I thought snakes only laid eggs. Do they do that? Are there some snakes who give birth to live babies and others who lay eggs?
Yeah, about three quarters of the snake and lizard species produce eggs and the other quarter produce live young. And the extraordinary thing is that that's changed independently from egg-laying to live-bearing in about 100 different evolutionary groups of snakes and lizards. So it's happened incredibly frequently. You know, the red-bellied black snake is a live-bearer. Blue-bellied black snakes that are a close relative are egg-layers. And so you get this wonderful mix and match where even very closely related species can differ in the way that they produce their kids.
Well, why is there the difference?
There's a really consistent pattern that when reptiles go into very cold areas, they change from egg-laying to live-bearing. And what seems to be happening is that the ground is just too cold for eggs to develop properly. But if mum keeps the eggs inside her body, in her uterus, she can go and sit in the sunshine, she can keep those eggs warm, they can develop very quickly, and they develop into healthy little snakelings, and it's just a much better way to play the game.
As we were watching this video, we were kind of like watching it from just sort of hiding under our desks almost. This was a YouTube video. I mean, it's pathetic. Yes, it's pathetic. But it is kind of amazing watching this big mother snake writhe and then wriggle out. I think it's like 15 baby snakes came wriggling out of her at great velocity and started thrashing around in the dirt. And, of course, the kids, I think, were shooting the video, going, running up close and then running up close. Do you have any thoughts about why we're like that around, why a lot of people, not you, obviously, but a lot of people are like that around snakes?
It's pretty deep-seated, I think. There's been some work done with newborn babies looking at how much their eyes dilate when you show them photographs of snakes versus spiders versus furry mammals and so on. And there does seem to be some pretty hardwired aversion to snakes in many people, but it's enormously exaggerated by the fact that mum and dad scream and say you shouldn't go near that. There's been work with young monkeys showing that mum and dad's responses really do make baby monkeys very frightened of snakes. And so I think it's a mix of genes and environment.
You went to study the sex life of the black snake when you came back to Sydney. How much do we know about the mating process, if you like, the reproductive process of the black snake when you started working on it?
Well, in terms of sort of the broader context of how it fits into the animal's ecology, we knew nothing. Snakes are incredibly difficult to work on. They're very secretive. They're not active a lot of the time. They're very hard to find. The development of miniature radio transmitters in the late 60s suddenly made it possible to go out and relocate your snake consistently. And that meant that if you were inclined to being a voyeur of snake sexuality, you finally had a way that you could pop transmitters into a bunch of snakes in the local population and reliably go out and find them. And so you could try and look at, yeah, when Harry met Sally and what happened.
Why the black snake? Why did you choose that?
Black snakes are phenomenal creatures. They're big, which meant that particularly in the early days when the transmitters were quite large, you could get a transmitter in without worrying the snake too much. They're active during the day, which makes it a lot easier to actually watch them. They tend to be pretty bold and mellow and not worry too much about the fact that people are nearby. And they're often in quite open habitats. So that, again, that makes it possible for you to sit down quietly 20 metres away with a pair of binoculars and look in some detail at how these creatures are interacting socially. It'd be much harder to do with the snake that was burrowing under the ground or up in the tree or active at night.
Still, Rick, you are studying a venomous snake while it's mating. Now, creatures, when they're mating, tend to be a bit thingy, don't they? I mean, they tend to be a bit touchy. How close did you need to be able to be to the snake to observe it?
Well, a lot of the work we did was out in the Macquarie Marshes in western New South Wales, very open country, and it's full of emus. And I think for that reason, the snakes just didn't seem to worry about people. I think they thought we were just funny-looking emus. And so I quite often had snakes slithering between my feet in the course of chasing each other or looking for a girlfriend or whatever. There was never the slightest hint that they would ever retaliate or treat me as an enemy. I mean, why would a snake bother to bite me unless it had a good reason to do so?
Brown snakes are known to be a bit more jumpy than black snakes. Is that right?
Brown snakes are, jumpy is a good word for it. They're nervous snakes. They're easily threatened. You can easily convince a brown snake that you're a sufficient threat to it, that it really ought to bite you to make sure that you go away. They really don't want to. We did some studies. A student of mine, Pat Whitaker, and I had transmitters in a bunch of brown snakes out near Leeton, and we walked out up to them more than 100 times to within a metre of the snake. And despite all of the stories about how brown snakes will hurl themselves upon you, none of those snakes tried to bite us. They either sat still and pretended they weren't there, or they ran the other direction.
So studying the black snake, is there a mating season for them?
Yes, they come out from hibernation from their sort of overwintering logs and burrows and so on in September, round about now. The boys bask in the sunshine and get the testes going and make the sperm that they're going to need.
When you say get the testes going, what do you mean? Well, the testes enlarge, or what?
Well, yes, they enlarge. They're shrunk right down when they're not being used throughout most of the year. The cold-blooded animals, the ectotherms, are real energy misers. If you're not using something, you shut it down. You know, the python in your garage would have shut down its stomach, essentially, for a month or so until it got a meal, and then it would have upregulated it and made it a great big fat stomach to digest that possum. So that's what they do with their testes.
Snake test, I mean, this is going to sound vaguely juvenile, I know, but when we think of testes, we think of external genitalia. That's not going to be great for a snake that's got to crawl along the ground, does it? So is that right?
Yeah, that's right. They're all tucked inside, as they are in birds. There's two of them, one on either side of the body. They're connected to separate penises on either side of the body as well.
What do you mean by separate penises?
Well, there are two penises. A male has a left-hand penis and a right-hand penis. The left-hand penis is connected to the left-hand testicle, and the right-hand penis is connected to the right-hand testicle.
Well, you're an evolutionary biologist. Why on earth would they need two? I mean, presumably they can't impregnate two female snakes at the same time, can they?
No, they only use one penis at a time. They do use them alternately, mostly, so I think it gives them a chance to use up the sperm on one side, and then if they meet another girlfriend the next day, before that system has got a chance to replenish itself, they get to use the other side.
So it's an efficiency thing then, by and large. That's why they're just a little bit of extra piping to make the system work a little bit better. How do the males and females find one another?
The life of a snake is really all about scent. It's about chemicals. You know, their vision is probably okay, but they're very close to the ground. It's hard to see very much. And they're incredibly good at detecting very faint chemical traces. So as a female snake moves across the ground, she leaves tiny traces of herself behind. A lot of it is fat molecules on the surface of the body, probably there is waterproofing. We have fat molecules on the surface of our body. When we hit puberty, we get pimples, and that's because hormones in our blood change those fat molecules a little bit. And so those fat molecules bear the signature that she's a reproductive female. And the male will flick his tongue out, searching the ground, and when he finds the trail of a reproductive female, he will follow it often for kilometres until he can find it.
Kilometres, right, that long. And when two males are going for the same female, is there a contest?
It depends on the species and even the population. So that your diamond pythons around Sydney, the boys are smaller than the girls. A single reproductive girl will attract five or six boyfriends, so it's quite a pile of snakes, and they just take turns mating with her. And there's absolutely no sign of aggression. But if you drive a couple of hundred kilometres north, the same species is the carpet snake. It's brown rather than black and yellow. And there, the boys are big bruisers. They're larger than the girls, and they fight like hell. And they rip great holes in each other in the course of battle. So it very much depends on the species.
Right. Yeah, take from that what you will about men and women, I suppose, males and females in any kind of species. The sex act itself that the snake performs, the black snakes you were studying particularly, is that brief? Is that a long drawn out process? Do they couple for a while? How does that go?
They can be coupled for hours and hours. It's pretty subtle stuff. There's a combat dance between males, which is quite dramatic, where they raise themselves up and wrestle, which is often misinterpreted as mating, but actual mating, the male manages to insert one of his penises, and then they just lie there pretty much side by side. If she wants to wander off under a log, she'll drag him along with her, but they may stay connected for hours.
How does she drag him along with her?
Well, just exactly as it sounds, the penis in snakes has got a lot of spines on it. It's kept inside out, and so it's turned inside out inside the female, and those spines anchor the male into the female, so that if she decides to take off, he really doesn't have too much option except to go along.
My female producers have just run screaming from the production booth on that thought, Rick. That's amazing. When the lady snake, that's a strange word, the female snake becomes pregnant, what do they look like typically? Do they really bulge up? I mean,
yeah, so that it's very obvious when you've got a female snake in late pregnancy. The rear half of her body is enormously swollen. Black snakes are interesting because the females gather together when they get pregnant. They stop feeding, probably because it's just too hard to keep moving around, and they all live together in the same burrow. And in the morning, they come out and bask together. And one of the great sights of the Australian bush is half a dozen big female pregnant black snakes just lying intertwined in the sunshine.
Morning, girls. Yeah. And are they vulnerable to predators themselves when they're like that?
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the reasons they gather together. Mm. They can probably detect the approach of predators more because there's more of them. And, of course, it would be a brave predator indeed that would leap into a pile of snakes like that.
In the 80s, you went to Canada to study a snake called the red-sided garter snake. What kind of a snake is that, Rick?
It's a harmless snake. It's related to grass snakes and water snakes in North America and Europe. A beautiful little snake, only about 50 centimetres in length.
Like the size of a whip snake, that sort of thing. Is it?
Yeah,
like
a little bit more heavy-bodied. But it's the extreme north of the range. You know, we're talking north of Winnipeg, minus 40 degrees in winter, a very long winter. And the only way that snakes can survive there is if they can get very deep down underground during winter. And there's very few places they can do that. So all of the snakes for miles around gather back together into these communal dens, and you get 50,000 snakes all going down the same hole in the ground in autumn and coming back out again in spring.
Did you just say 50,000 snakes going down the same hole?
Yeah, and that's a medium-sized den. I think there's quite a few more than that in the really big dens, but nobody's been silly enough to try to count them.
Good God. So how big are these dens then? Are they the size of a swimming pool or thereabouts?
Yeah, probably smaller than a swimming pool. It's just a small depression in the ground. There's usually an underground stream where the top has collapsed, and so there are fissures that enable the snakes to go down through and get deep underground. It looks like nothing special during summer or winter. You'd hardly notice it. You'd walk straight past it. But in spring or autumn, you know for sure you found a snake den.
How do you what does that look like? Describe the site of that.
Oh, look, it truly is a seething mass of snakes. 95% of the ones that are active at any time are males. The girls come out slowly. The boys are hanging around trying to intercept them. And so there's this seething carpet of snakes. They're crawling over each other, and it sounds like the wind in the trees because they have quite rough scales. And so you can hear them 100 metres away from the den before you see them. And you get there, and it's just this perpetual motion of these gorgeous little creatures roaming around, all looking for love.
All looking for love. So, all right, so this is writhing mass of, what, 50,000 snakes. Oh, my God. All writhing in this giant pit and looking for someone to have sex with.
Yeah, and, you know, they can be up to half a metre deep in snakes, so that in the wrong weather, if you get very hot weather, you'll actually get a lot of snakes crushed to death at the bottom of this pile. And when the snakes all go in the evening, as they do, it leaves behind these poor remnant corpses that haven't been able to find their way back up through the crush of other horny male snakes.
On ABC Radio, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler. On air, online, and on your mobile.
I want to talk to you about your time in China now. You went to a tiny island off the Chinese coast called Shedao Island. How did you find out about this place, Rick?
I was actually visiting a friend at the Australian Reptile Park just north of Sydney, a guy called John Weigel, who had an enormous collection of books about reptiles. And I arrived one day to just have a chat with John, and he said, "Hey, look at this book I just found." And it was called China Snake Island. And it was full of pictures of pit vipers of a species I'd never seen before, with text mostly in Chinese but a bit in English. And it became clear that what this book was at least claiming was that this tiny little island had tens of thousands of these venomous snakes that ambush the small birds that breed in Siberia but then come down and live in the Southeast Asia in summer.
What do you mean ambush? How do they do that?
They coil up on the tree branches or on the ground, places where the birds are likely to land. And so a small tree, you know, the size of something in your backyard, might have 20 or 30 of these pit vipers on it. Sometimes
20 or 30?
Yeah, piled up two or three deep with these little faces all looking out at you and looking out at the branch where the bird is likely to land. Anyway, look, I'd never heard of anything like this. I was excited to try to get there. And so I contacted some friends who had contacts in China and was able to finally get there and you know, was the first Western scientist to get a look at the fabled Shedao.
And when you walk ashore on that island, is that huge snake population immediately visible once you're there?
Pretty much. I mean, it would be difficult to walk more than half a dozen steps on Shedao without seeing a pit viper. The estimates are about 1 per metre squared as a density. So that as you're walking down the path, you've got to put every foot down very carefully because there could be a snake underneath the leaf litter.
No human could live there, clearly, under those circumstances.
There are some rangers that live there to protect the snakes. China's actually done a really good job of protecting this snake. There's something about the symbolism of this pit viper, this unique species on this little rocky island that somehow has resonated with the Chinese people. And so they protect them very vigorously. There are three or four rangers that live there during the times when snakes are active, and tourists come to have a look. But the snakes are only active for about 3 or 4 weeks in spring and 3 or 4 weeks in autumn, which is the time the birds come through. And the rest of the time, the snakes are completely inactive.
You mean they just lie around, are they? Lying around on the tree or on the ground or in the burrows or something?
They're in a burrow. Right. They're pretty much gone. So you could go to Shedao any other time of year and not realise it had any snakes. But as soon as the bird migration begins, the birds don't like to fly over open water. And so Shedao is beautifully placed as a stepping stone. And as the birds are moving either north or south, they're getting tired. They see this nice island. They think, oh, it's a good place for a break. Depending on the direction of the wind, you wake up in the morning on the island and there's tens of thousands of birds have arrived. And quite a few of those birds are unfortunately already fluttering around and on the ground, dying of pit viper venom.
Right. So they use the viper to the venom to disable their prey. It's not just a defence mechanism.
No. It's all about eating an enormous amount over the period of 2 or 3 weeks when the birds are available, then starving for the next few months, and then eating again. So that venom is all about knocking out birds very quickly.
So they can consume the envenomed bird, and the venom does them no harm then, clearly?
Snakes are immune to their own venom, by and large. You just need a few small genetic changes to do that. The venom probably even gets digestion going, so that you can start to digest the bird even as you're swallowing it.
So here's my horror movie here. A couple of medieval Chinese fishermen get shipwrecked on Shedao Island. It's fine. They say, this is quite nice here. We can go about our fishing here. And then they're just on the cusp of seasonal change. And they wake up one day to see hundreds of thousands of snakes coming out of everywhere, all over the place. That's a pretty good movie, I reckon. Terrifying.
Yeah, it's a spectacular place because a lot of the snakes are up trees and they're beautifully camouflaged against the trees. So they're really hard to see. And so as you're pushing your way through the forest, you know, you're watching the ground, but you're also watching the branches around your face. And every so often you'll suddenly become aware that there's a snake, you know, very, very close to you, sitting there, perhaps getting a little irritated at your presence. They're pretty good natured creatures. And by and large, you know, we didn't have any problems, but there are a heck of a lot of snakes on Shedao.
What does the pit refer to for the pit viper? What does the pit mean?
If you look sort of head on at a pit viper, it's got a little hole, a little orifice below the eye, quite close to the nostril. And it's just a small hole on either side of the head that's got sensory hairs behind it that can detect temperature. So that what the pit organ does is it tells the snake if there's a hot object or a cold object in front of it. So even if there's no vision, if there's no light, the snake can still read temperature like a thermal camera.
Right, so that would sense the kind of warmth of a bird.
Yeah.
And so they'd have great success at night then, wouldn't they? Just going, latching onto a bird in the dark through this gland. What was the experiment you did to try and figure out how this worked?
Yeah, well, I mean, people had known about pit organs and they'd looked in the laboratory and they'd shown that they were fired by small differences in temperature. A couple of thousandths of a degree centigrade are enough to fire the cells at the back of a pit organ. But nobody had actually shown that snakes use that in order to decide whether or not to launch a strike. So I got some balloons that I'd brought with me to the island and I filled them with either hot or cold water. And I slid those balloons into stockings to which I had glued the feathers of defunct birds that I found lying around the island. And I then dangled that on a fishing line with a small fishing rod in front of pit vipers that were sitting in ambush position. And the idea was that if they could detect temperature, then that the hot water inside the balloon would initiate a strike, whereas the cold model would not. And indeed, it worked like a charm. You know, you'd creep up, you'd dangle it, trying to, you know, channel your inner bird and make it sort of bounce around, and then suddenly, bang, the balloon would pop. The snake moved so fast you often couldn't even see it strike. But it was very clear that pit vipers do indeed recognise the temperature of the object in front of them and use that in their decision whether or not to launch a strike.
Well, this brings us to the toads. In more recent years, you've been based in the Northern Territory, somewhere not far from Kakadu, at a place called Fog Dam. Tell me a bit about this place and why you call this place in the Northern Territory Snake Heaven, Rick.
Yeah, I started working up in Kakadu and in the 80s, and you had to stop in Darwin on the way up, and people told me about this place called Fog Dam that had an extraordinary density of pythons. And so I went out to look at it, and it was absolutely true. It's a dam that was built on a natural floodplain just off the Adelaide River for an abortive attempt at rice growing back in the 60s. The rice growing never really worked. They tried to mechanise it. They thought that they could do it much more efficiently than these people in Asia who were out there planting things by hand. And it never succeeded. It went bankrupt very quickly. But they left the dam behind. And the dam wall, which is only about 2 kilometres long, is a magnet for snakes that are moving between the floodplain and the dam. And if you go down the dam wall at night, you see an enormous number of snakes. And as part of the rice-growing enterprise, the federal government had built a small village just a couple of kilometres away, a place called Middle Point, designed for CSIRO researchers to look at the wildlife and make sure that the rice-growing worked okay. And so here was the perfect accommodation. So I've been renting Middle Point Village from the Northern Territory Government for the last 10 years.
Given that it's known as Snake Heaven, I'm guessing property values aren't perhaps as high as they might be in Harbourfront Sydney, for example, thereabouts. So you must have picked it up a bit cheap. So that's where you've been living all this time. And as part of your research, what kind of studies were you doing of the snakes there?
Well, we looked at a wide variety of issues about the ecology of tropical reptiles and amphibians. I mean, there's actually very little known about wildlife ecology in the tropics. Most parts of the tropics worldwide are actually pretty difficult to work in. Australia is a real exception. And here we had terrific infrastructure, abundant animals, good educational system, and the Australian Research Council was kind enough to provide funding for a lot of it. The main focus was looking at how year-to-year variation in wet season rainfall changes the abundance of prey for the snakes, like rats, of fishes and frogs, and how that affects the biology of the snakes. It all looks terribly clever in retrospect because we all know about climate change and we all know that it's useful to understand how variation in climate will affect wildlife species. But at the time, I didn't know about climate change. I just wanted to find out how year-to-year variation in wet season rainfall patterns was affecting the animals that I found interesting.
So, Rick, how did you come to realise that the cane toad might pose a threat to your research at Fog Dam in the Territory?
Well, there'd been anecdotes and rumours about cane toad impact. You know, the Uncle Ken found a dead goanna beside the outhouse the week after Aunt Mary saw the first toad kind of thing. But we really didn't have any good information about what the impact of toads was, but there was a lot of speculation that they would be devastating. Clearly, it was an issue that was worth looking at. And here I was, I had phenomenally detailed background information on a tropical floodplain after 20 years of study, and this high-profile pest was looming over the hill and was about to reach us, likely to devastate the fauna that I'd been studying, but at the same time giving us a unique opportunity to understand what a biological invasion looks like and perhaps what we could do about it.
You see, I think I had always thought of the cane toad as being a threat as a major competitor to, like, native frogs, for mm-hmm. example. But it seems they pose a much larger threat to animals, much larger than them. How does that work?
Yeah, I used to think that way. I used to think competition would be a big deal, but we did some studies and it wasn't. The big problem is that we have no native toads in Australia. And toads, as a group, have an incredibly potent set of chemicals that they use to defend themselves. You know, if you're a frog, you don't have claws and teeth and so on that you can use to fight off that snake. What you can have is very potent poisons in your skin. And toads have got a group called bufotoxins that give you a heart attack very, very quickly if you are exposed to them. And so the big problem we have in Australia is that our predators didn't evolve with toads. They don't know that they should leave toads alone. So when the toads arrive, the goannas, the blue-tongued lizards, the quolls, the crocodiles think that this is just another type of frog. They eat it and they're dead almost immediately. We've had about 90 to 95% mortality of those big predators within a few months of toads arriving right across tropical Australia.
Oh, 90 to 95%. Mm. That's so how far away were the toads when you started to ring the klaxon on this one?
They were probably marching into the Northern Territory and about to hit Kakadu. There'd been research before, but the toads had been moving quite slowly, about 10 to 15 kilometres a year, as they were released in Queensland in 1935, and they bred and they started spreading westwards. But they were moving at a rate that would have had me in the nursing home long before the toads had arrived at my study site, so I never thought about it. But the toads accelerated as their invasion progressed for reasons that we've actually looked into in great detail ever since. And so the toads managed to arrive in 2005 when I was still hale and hearty and the project was still very much going. I think I was a bit slow on the uptake. I didn't realise until probably 3 or 4 years before the toads arrived that it was happening. And so we had to scramble to get ourselves ready and work out what we needed to find out.
I'm really quite alarmed by this idea that the toads have greatly picked up speed. If they could arrive that much more quickly, how have they done this and how fast were they going at the time?
Yeah, it's extraordinary. The toads at the invasion front move like no other amphibians in the world. A toad in Queensland lives in the same place. It lives in your backyard. If you put a transmitter on it, it'll be within 10 metres of that spot tomorrow. It won't move much at night. Go back to the same spot. On the invasion front, the toads are running down the roads because they can go quicker that way, and they run all night. They can move 2 or 3 kilometres in a night. They'll spend the day resting in a little patch of grass by the side of the road, and as soon as it gets dark, they're back on the road and off they go. And they keep moving in the same direction every night so that they've got a compass, and it means that they cover enormous distances. They're now spreading at about 60 kilometres per year, many times faster than they were when they first started.
How robust are these toads?
Well, toads are tough. They can handle extremes of all kinds of conditions, and we've shown that they have evolved very rapidly to deal with the very hot, dry conditions that they're encountering as they move from Queensland across into the Kimberley. And so the toads have become a model system for rapid evolution. You know, the guys at the front are a different shape, a different size, different physiology, different behaviour. You know, for example, if you want to be a pioneer toad, you need to be bold. And if you put toads from Queensland versus Western Australia in an open box, the guys from Queensland sit in a corner and the guys from Western Australia run around. If you breed those toads, raise their offspring in captivity and test the offspring when they grow up, the offspring are just like mum and dad were. So it's genuine evolution. Toads have evolved to deal with the challenges of Australia and with invasion.
How omnivorous are they? What will they eat?
They eat just about anything that fits into their mouths, and they got pretty big mouths, but they really like small black objects like beetles and ants and so on. They do get the occasional baby bird and mouse, but really probably 95% of what we see inside a toad are very small bugs.
So with these robust, omnivorous, fast toads heading your way in the territory, what kind of animals were at risk from a toad invasion from where you in the area you're studying in near Kakadu?
Well, I mean, we didn't know at the beginning, and so we had to run a series of trials, and I had a bunch of graduate students that did fantastic work looking at birds and fishes and turtles and crocodiles and snakes and lizards and, you know, all the other groups we could look at. It actually turned out that competition wasn't a big deal, but being fatally poisoned if you ate a toad was a big deal. But some native species, like the rodents, the rats, were capable of dealing with the toad's poisons. They weren't in trouble. The birds in the same category. Others, the small predators, were in trouble if they ate a big toad, but because they were small predators, mostly they would eat a small toad, and a small toad doesn't have very much poison. It makes you sick, but it doesn't kill you. And once you've eaten one or two small toads and you've got desperately sick, you realise that these things are a really bad dietary choice, and you stop eating toads of any size. So the interesting pattern really was that we got devastation in the big predators,
the crocs, goannas,
blue-tongued skinks, quolls, the things that eat really big toads, they were the ones that really collapsed. But the small predators were unaffected. And of course, the things that used to be eaten by the goannas, for example, were having a holiday. Suddenly 90% of the goannas are killed, and so things are terrific. And so many species actually became more common after toads arrived. Most of the snakes that we thought would collapse actually are now more common at Fog Dam than they were before the toad invasion.
So there was a bit of a clue there. At the time, what was the common method of dealing with the cane toad invasion?
Look, people had been trying all sorts of things. There'd been a lot of money spent on sophisticated attempts at biocontrol that hadn't worked. Mostly people were picking up toads at night, walking around with a flashlight, and then killing the toads humanely, gassing them or putting them in the freezer or whatever. But it clearly wasn't really having much effect. A single female toad can have 40,000 eggs. So you simply cannot remove toads quicker than they can replace themselves. We needed a new method. We needed a way to stop toads from breeding, or else we needed a totally new approach.
So having noticed that the small predators were doing okay and the large predators weren't because they were eating the big toads with the poison, what was it about your own life story and your experience with toxins that helped you give you the idea of how to deal with this?
Yeah, well, the process of this learning to avoid noxious substances is called conditioned taste aversion, and many, many species have got it, including our own species. And my own story is that when I was about 17 years of age, which is about 50 years ago, I was on a camping trip and somebody foolishly gave me a bottle of scotch and I foolishly drank it and I was desperately ill all of the next day. And 50 years later, I still cannot bear the scent of scotch. It's socially crippling. It's a huge problem for me, but it just shows how enduring taste aversion can be. And the frogs and the lizards and the crocs are just as smart as I am. If you give them a chance to have that experience of being nauseated, they recognise that this is a really bad thing to eat.
My dad, at the age of 17 in the Air Force, got alcohol poisoning from a bottle of gin and was never for the rest of his life able to even sniff, get even a whiff of gin without getting green at the gills. Mm-hmm. Is that what it's like? It sort of it gives you this lifelong nauseous aversion to the thing that's poisoned you.
And you can see it's an incredibly useful trick. You know, if you're wandering around encountering potentially edible things and one of them is going to kill you, it's really useful for you to know that and avoid it afterwards.
So what was the program you came up with then, you and your fellow scientists, in order to deal with the cane toad invasion?
Yeah, I mean, sitting there looking at the results of those trials that we ran, it became clear that if the first toad you met was a small one, you'd get sick and you'd learn not to eat cane toads.
And you'd puke it up and that would be the end of it. Right.
And if the first toad you met was a big one, you'd eat it and you'd die of a heart attack. Now, the problem we have is that because of the dynamics of the invasion, it's only big toads at the invasion front. The little guys can't keep up. The pregnant girls can't keep up. And so the toads at the front are all large and they don't breed much at all. They just keep going. And that means that those poor goannas and crocodiles and so on are almost certain to meet a very large toad because they're the first toads that arrive and so they're killed. And so the idea was very simple. We could release small toads just in advance of the invasion front, in a site that we knew would be overrun by big toads within a month or two. That would give the predators a chance to learn so that when the big toads came along, the predators would ignore them.
That's very clever. It's counterintuitive, but it's very, very clever. Was this idea controversial? I mean, you are introducing more toads, aren't you, effectively?
Indeed. And at that stage, we still had the community groups who were trying very hard. You know, these are volunteers that are out there every night. The thought that some southern academic was suggesting we should release more toads in advance of the front really flew in the face of everything they were doing, and predictably they thought it was the silliest idea they'd ever heard. So I got a lot of grief, and I really thought that the only way for this to work would be if we had the community groups on side, because their energy really is critical to the whole thing. So rather than trying to push too hard, we set out to do a series of studies to see if indeed it worked. We started out with quolls, these little cat-sized marsupials that were being raised at the Territory Wildlife Park and released because quolls are desperately endangered now because of the toad. We trained half of them not to eat toads. The other half we didn't train. The untrained guys died within hours as soon as they met a toad.
Hours?
Hours often, yeah. It was awful. You'd start radio tracking the toad and you'd hardly gone 200 metres down the road when the quoll is lying there dying beside a toad that it's grabbed. But the trained guys survived really well. We did the same thing with blue-tongued lizards at Kununurra, and we did the same thing with the big yellow-spotted goannas, the big monitor lizards at Umbulgari in the Kimberley. A woman named Georgia Ward-Fear, who's now running the Toast Aversion Project, was the main player there. And in every case, it had a huge impact on survival. And in the case of the goannas, 50% of our goannas that we'd trained were still alive 18 months after the project started. All of the untrained guys had died within a few months of toad invasion.
Oh, man. Well, here's the critical thing. What about the babies of the animals who were taste averse to the cane toad venom, the ones that had puked up the venom, learned to keep away from the toad, and then had babies? Were those babies also averse to cane toad venom?
Well, the critical thing is that it's a very brief window when there's only big toads around. Within a couple of years, the pregnant girls have caught up, they're breeding, you know, 40,000 eggs in a clutch, there are baby toads everywhere. So that if you can keep predators alive for long enough for them to breed once or twice, their babies will grow up in a world where there are plenty of small toads around. So you just need a single generation of education, a single year, and that is enough to maintain that predator population in perpetuity, because the next generation is exposed to baby toads as well as big ones, and so it gets a chance to learn on its own.
Do they pass on the aversion anyway, though, genetically or epigenetically?
We know that the offspring do survive. We know from a couple of recent studies by a group we work with, but it's not actually from my own stuff, that there is a genetically inherited tendency in quolls for populations from areas where toads have been present for 80 years, they tend not to eat toads even when they're babies. So there is almost certainly some heritable aspect, whether it's genetics or epigenetics, we don't yet know.
I suppose the upshot of this is, if this is true, we just have to accept the presence of cane toads until we can find some kind of, I don't know, viral bullets that can wipe them all out. We just have to accept that they're here to stay until that point. And the point is then to train the native animals to be able to withstand their presence. Is this the point you're making here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an encouraging story and that the wildlife has proved much more resilient than we thought. A lot of these predators are common in Queensland where the toads have been present for 80 years, so they do recover. And we have got systems now that we can use to help control toad numbers in local areas. But I think you're right. We have to learn to live with cane toads. We have to accept that invaders are going to keep coming. We need much better ways to deal with the sorts of challenges that they pose.
The whole genome of the cane toad has very recently been mapped. Does this mean we can look forward to a day when perhaps a virus can be introduced to the cane toad species that might wipe it out? And would that be a good thing to have another kind of very radical and very quick change to the environment with the absence of cane toads if such a thing happened?
Yeah, look, the sequencing the genome gives us all sorts of opportunities. One of them is the virus. You know, we have got a few viruses that are embedded in the toad genome, showing that they have infected toads and so on. The problem, of course, is the toad is there to remind us that this was a biological control solution to beetles in sugarcane fields, and that really didn't work out all that well.
There's a lesson here.
Yeah, I believe there is.
There's a lesson here.
Yes, so I think we have to move carefully. Let's move. Let's look at it, but let's move very carefully.
Let's move very carefully indeed, because we've been wrong, badly wrong about this stuff in the past. This has been a completely amazing story. Congratulations on the Prime Minister's Prize, which is clearly very well deserved. It's been such an absolute pleasure speaking to you, Rick. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Rick Shine is Professor of Evolutionary Biology at the University of Sydney, and he wrote a book earlier this year called Cane Toad Wars. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.